Hi there, and welcome to the Skylight Books author reading series. If you'd like to learn more about us and our many upcoming author events, please visit skylightbooks.com, where you can browse our inventory, buy books, and join our Friends with Benefits Club. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook. To speak to a real live bookseller like me, please call 323-660-1175. Thanks for your support, and enjoy!
Today, we are uncommonly lucky to welcome Wallace Shawn with his latest book, Night Thoughts. He is an actor, playwright, essayist, comedian. Let's clap for him. And he's been investigated by the Vice Squad. He has officially been deemed a master dramatist. He also has something absolutely indelible about him, which is he is unusually likable. Get ready to start liking him any minute now. This slim little book, it's serious, it's moving, it's direct. It's a sort of stream of consciousness monologue style essay. It's doing a lot of what the best theater does, and it has been wonderfully well reviewed. It has been called impeccable, lovely, hilarious, thoughtful, pungent, delightful, provocative, short, easy, idiosyncratic, powerful, riveting, subtle, gentle, tricky, startling, unsettling, sensual, marvelous, mind and soul expanding, indispensable, bracing, brilliant, and funny. Let's please give him a warm round of applause.
Thank you. There's a lot going on here. Actually, it hasn't been reviewed. Not in print, anyway, which is, you know, for me, print is quite meaningful. But it has been reviewed online. I don't remember if they said any of those things. It's a long essay, and it is a stream of consciousness in a way, and it's made up of a lot of little fragments. And I can't read. I mean, it's very short. But I still can't read, that much of it. And in a way, it doesn't make any sense until you've read the whole thing. I don't know what I can say, except I'm going to read various fragments from it. And it is made up of these fragments, and each fragment is supposed to make some kind of sense, I guess. And I know I've been warned not to read for too long, and I won't tell you how long I'm going to read, because that could make you uncomfortable, but I it won't be too long. Really. And if it is, it's extremely hard to leave here. It's practically impossible. But anyway. Okay. And I am going to start at the beginning. And I'm going to read selected bits and hope that it adds up. And then we can... you can express your comments or ask any questions or whatever. Night. A hotel. A dark room on a high floor. Outside the hotel, miles of empty city streets, silent, gray, like gray fields in winter. Inside, I'm alone in a very cold room with a buzzing minibar. Through the window, far below in the street, I can see a couple of thin, solitary, wandering men, one with a hat cocked at a debonair angle. Then I turn on a dim lamp and stare at the newspaper, and my eye goes, as always, to the stories about crime, the murders, A crime of passion, jealousy, frenzy, a body falling in the shower. Strange deaths in a quiet suburb. An odd weapon, a serial killer. My senses quicken. My lethargy falls away. They're writing about me. Well, no. Not me, not quite. Not yet. But I know as I read that I'm not reading as the victim. I'm reading as the murderer. In a courtroom, the case of a robbery gone wrong. The thief had been inside the house when the man who owned it unexpectedly came home. The thief had gone after the man with a knife, and when he was asked, "Why did you stab him 38 times when you knew he was dead after the first blow?" The murderer's answer was, "I don't know." Then on the television, a different kind of murder. Brightly dressed university students in pools of blood, their books scattered all over the street. The Islamic State, a machine gun, screaming, sobbing, an Arab empire in the 14th century? I myself had good luck from the beginning. When I was a child, people were paid to take care of me. We lived in a large apartment in a very big city. And if my mother wanted something heavy to be moved from one room to another, or if she thought the dishwasher was making a peculiar sound, she would call the superintendent of the apartment building and someone would appear to fix the problem. For various reasons, my friends and I all turned out to be, to varying degrees, what people decades ago used to call downward mobile. Our positions in society are somewhat lower than the ones our parents held. During the years when I was growing up, my father never went to a grocery store to buy food. Other people did that for him. He never walked home from the grocery store carrying a bag of groceries. He never walked up flights of stairs to his apartment while carrying his groceries. I do those things. I live in a small building, and if there's a problem with the electricity or the plumbing, I can't ask a building superintendent to send someone over to fix it. All the same, my luck has held. I live in a quiet, tranquil part of town. I write, I read, I visit friends, I go to concerts, I go to restaurants. When I was 20, I learned about the lives people led in the Imperial Japanese court in the 11th century. It was all described in the novel The Tale of Genji by Lady Murasaki Shikibu and the Pillow Book of Sei Shanagon, which was a sort of diary or journal. I could tell right away that this was for me. Women and men who had nothing to do all day but speculate and talk about love and beauty. Or so it seemed. Reclining on pillows next to each other, they wrote letters and poems from early in the morning till late at night on perfumed paper of many different colors. It seemed like a life to aspire to, anyway. Obviously, I'm upset about what my species has turned out to be, the species that went mad and destroyed the planet. It's unbelievable to recall how respected and admired the human animal was at one time. It's as if the old family dog, once universally beloved, had suddenly become rabid. His muzzle now covered with foam, his presence terrifying. When I was in my late 20s, I visited a small dark apartment in a bohemian section of town, and it was much rougher than the apartments my friends and I had grown up in. The tiny sink in the bathroom looked like it hadn't even been installed by a professional plumber. I was frightened by the smallness and darkness of the apartment, and when I first walked into it, I felt very ill at ease. But after a while, the place began to seem rather warm and cozy, and I started to feel quite comfortable there, perhaps more comfortable than I'd ever felt in any other place, because I was drawn to the mysterious, alluring woman who lived in the apartment. She apparently didn't mind that the apartment was so small and dark. She seemed to think it wasn't really that bad. She could read there, she could even cook there, and she cooked quite a number of very delicious things. She could listen to music there. She had quite a few records. But at a certain moment, she shocked me by saying that she thought civilization might have been a mistake. A mistake from the beginning. Excuse me? My God, that was such an upsetting thing to say. It really disturbed me. I got very upset and couldn't understand what in the world she meant. Civilization? Civilization could only be good from my point of view. Without civilization, well, all the things I cared about, and actually, all the things she seemed to care about too, they wouldn't have existed. No books, no music, no bohemian section of the city, no city at all. She'd come to the city to find a kind of freedom that couldn't have existed without civilization. Even the relationship we were about to embark on couldn't have existed without civilization. And I could still remember the vivid images that had formed in my mind when I was a very young boy, and one of my teachers had spoken of the magnificent loam that had been created when the Nile overflowed its banks. So much that was glorious had grown out of the fertility of that extraordinary loam. Pyramids, paintings, astonishing sculptures. And I remembered the phrase, civilization means specialization. The brilliant idea that the sandal maker wouldn't need to grow food because he could get his food from the farmer in exchange for sandals. And the pharaoh didn't need to grow food or make sandals because the farmer and the sandal maker paid taxes to the pharaoh so he could be the pharaoh and buy food and sandals and hire painters and sculptors. Incredibly clever. And yet, what the woman in the apartment had said stayed with me for weeks, then for years. It stayed with me and upset me, and I kept thinking about it. And about two decades later, she stood beside me in a square in East Berlin as we read Brecht's poem, Carved in Stone. Wer baute das Siebentürger Theben? In den Brücken stehen die Namen von Königen. Haben die Königen die Felsenbrocken herbeigeschleppt? Who built Thebes with its seven gates? In books we're given the names of kings. Did the kings carry on their own backs those massive fragments of stone? In his 16-line poem, Brecht quarreled with the books. The books talked about the kings. The books Brecht had read and the books I had read praised the kings for the fantastic cities they'd built. The fantastic cities with their gates and their towers and their arches. For the writers of books and the readers of books, civilization was great. How fabulous to stand before these wondrous feats of construction and design. But it was a lie to say that the kings built the cities. They didn't build them. And for the peasants and slaves and prisoners of war who actually built them, civilization might not have been great. As more and more years of my own life followed on and on, I started to be able to see the past in the present, right in front of me, always more clearly, the story of civilization. The story of civilization was repeated in front of me every day. I'd even seen it in childhood. We all had. The horrors of the playground. The horrors of the schoolyard. The bigger, stronger kid, the kid with the luck to have a little extra strength, could make the weaker kid do what he wanted him to do. The candy bar was handed over, and nothing really could be done about it. We learned the simple lesson: strong triumphs over weak, among lions, among elks, among boys and girls. Men pin women to the ground, and right then they begin to believe that women are inferior, intellectually inferior, humanly inferior. The people with the guns learn that they can easily defeat the people with the spears, and they begin to say that people so easily defeated are savages, ignorant, and deserve to be slaves. For the lucky ones on the banks of the Nile, the lucky ones who were right there in the right place at the right time when the river overflowed, it was all fantastic. Fertile land. More could be grown than they even needed. A surplus. How amazing. So, should the surplus be shared with the less lucky people who lived farther from the river and had less fertile soil? No, we won't share it. And in fact, we'll use some of it to feed an army to defend us in case anyone doesn't agree with our plan to keep all the surplus for ourselves. For the lucky people, civilization just got more and more fun. And the process has never stopped. The jobs that lucky people have are different from the jobs that unlucky people have. Lucky people give orders. Unlucky people obey orders. Lucky people may actually love their jobs. Their jobs can be lively. Their jobs can be thrilling. When they go to work, lucky people are treated with respect because lucky people respect each other and everyone else respects them too. But many unlucky people aren't treated with respect because lucky people, if they want to, can treat them with contempt. And even if the lucky people don't want to treat them with contempt, can they really respect them? No, not really. How could they really respect people whom they know they could so easily treat with contempt? Not long ago, I visited some wealthy friends, a young husband and wife who'd employed the same housekeeper for many years. The housekeeper was a warm, friendly, very sensible woman. She took care of the children, did some cleaning and cooking, and I too had known her for quite a while and always called her by her first name. She'd worked for the husband before he was married. And when she and the husband chatted and joked together, I could see all the husband's customary tension falling away. He basked in the affection and the intimacy of this relationship they had. It was easy for him, because he knew where he stood. The relationship's terms had been settled long ago. They proceeded from one day to the next on the basis that, after all, he was a superior being. And so, that being the standing assumption, they both behaved in an appropriate style. He with gentle goodwill toward her, she with a kind of amused, informal, joshing deference toward him. And at a certain point during my visit, she knelt down to pick up the toys that the children had left under the dining room table. And I suddenly imagined that she was throwing the toys with all of her might into the husband's face, blinding him, and then that she was smashing his head into the corner of the marble tabletop with overpowering force two or three times until he was dead. Well, such things don't really happen, do they? Of course, the housekeeper knows that only bad consequences would follow if she should murder her employer. And, of course, most of the time, she actually believes that he's a superior being, and so there isn't anything objectionable about the simple fact that he has a superior position in the world. And there's no particular reason to think about murdering him. And it does seem to be the case that he is superior. After all, if he weren't superior, why would he be the employer and she the housekeeper? If he weren't superior, why would she be working for him 6 days a week doing all the things he asks her to do? If he weren't superior, why wouldn't he occasionally be working for her? Obviously, that never happens. Every day they play the same parts, and even after years, there's never been a single day on which she gave the orders and he obeyed them, and so it seems awfully clear that he must be superior. And what does he himself think? Well, he's much too refined to say this out loud, but yes, he secretly thinks that he does possess some special hidden merit, something deep inside him that does make him superior, something perhaps reflected in his way of speaking, his accent, the fact that he excelled in certain subjects at school, his ability to work so seriously at his desk. And he has a good idea of how a superior person would walk and dress and behave, and so he acts that way. He actually impersonates a superior being every moment of his waking life. But of course, at the same time, he's well aware that he's a total fake. He's a fraud. He's an imposter. What can one say? One has to marvel at the amazing ability of the human mind to accept and contain at the same time two entirely contradictory propositions. Because the remarkable fact is that she also is not at all stupid, and she also knows that the game the two of them play every day is completely insane. She also knows that, of course, he's not really superior, and she's not really inferior. It's just that he's had much, much better luck. He was given some opportunities, and he took advantage of them. She knows he's an imposter. And that's a very scary thought, and she knows she has to try not to think it, because if she actually thought it for too long, she might want to kill him, which is exactly what she doesn't want to do. She knows very well that the way to find happiness in this world is not to hate your life, but to somehow learn how to accept your life. Take pride in your work, whatever it is. Derive whatever pleasure you can from whatever surrounds you, the sky, the people you like, the light falling on the brick wall. Let's stop and ask ourselves, who belongs to the group of the lucky? Certainly, we're all aware of the famous group of very, very rapacious people who are the best known and most successful subset of the group of people who are very, very lucky. And those would be the millionaires and the billionaires who are reasonably called the 1%. But I'd say the lucky are a larger group. Roughly speaking, I'd say that if your city has not been bombed, if your loved ones have not been raped, tortured, or killed, if you've never been harassed or beaten by the police, if you're not afraid to walk after dark on the street where you live, if you have a place to live in which you're not unbearably cold in the winter or unbearably hot in the summer, if you eat two or three fairly healthy meals a day, and if you're not regularly shouted at or threatened or punished by your boss or his managers at work, then you probably count as a lucky person. And so that would include, for example, a very large number of the citizens of the United States and Great Britain and most European countries. Those citizens are plausibly to be counted among the lucky because, whether they know it or not, Their relatively comfortable lives are made possible by the twist of luck that arranged for them to be born in prosperous countries. And the prosperity of their countries derives in very large part from the unjust exploitation of various unlucky human beings, some still living and some now dead. The United States, for example, has been engaged since 1945 in an extraordinarily audacious attempt to use its diplomatic abilities, its skill at trickery and deceit, and most of all its military power, to place the government of basically every other country on Earth under its direct or indirect control. It's an attempt that obviously has had good years and bad years, but that, on the whole, has been surprisingly successful. The purpose of this amazing project has simply been to preserve an international status quo, an international balance of power, which allows a lot of Americans to remain rich. Many individual Americans have opposed some of the more brutal and horrible regimes that their government has succeeded in imposing on certain unlucky nations. And they've spoken, written, and marched in opposition to many of the wars and campaigns of the U.S. government. And they've voted against political candidates whose policies they found particularly heartless and militaristic. Nevertheless, even these dissenting individuals have probably benefited personally in their material lives from the great prosperity of their country, which would not exist were it not for the powerful international position of the United States. Certain particular policies of the U.S. government have undoubtedly been self-defeating and, in their own terms, counterproductive, and have served to weaken rather than strengthen the position of the United States. But it would be foolish for any American to declare with any degree of certainty if the clothes they're wearing are comfortable and clean, if they can travel to a different city or a different country on a family vacation, if they can go to the movies or eat in restaurants, that the brutal policies of the United States, financed by the taxes they've paid, have not played a role in allowing them to enjoy these comforts. And of course, the exploitation that brings prosperity to the prosperous goes very far back into the past as well. The people of Great Britain and Europe are still benefiting today from the exploitation of colonized people in the 19th century. And the people who live in the United States today are still benefiting from the exploitation of 19th century enslaved people in the South, whose unpaid labor made possible the creation in the North of the American industrial cornucopia. And also from the deaths of the many millions of Native Americans who once walked and slept and cooked and thought on the very spots where you as citizens now go to buy espresso machines or reenact battles or ski. We need a better world right away, this week. An upheaval is desirable, perhaps it's inevitable. And yet we've learned some things about ourselves over the last 100 years, and that knowledge makes a difference. We can't ignore the things we've learned. If, as a species, we start to find our way through effort and imagination toward a different sort of world, certain individuals and groups will find themselves taking the first steps, and one has to hope that they will keep in mind what we've learned very much in mind. And the most important thing we've learned is that we don't understand ourselves. We have to remember the murderer in the courtroom who said, "I don't know." We have to recognize that no matter who we are, even if we happen to be people who can honestly claim to have spent our whole lives struggling to create a better and more just world, all the same, We are human beings, and we don't know ourselves. We don't understand ourselves. But we do know for sure that other people and all living things need to be protected from us because we're very dangerous. We may be unknowable, and it would be insane to trust us. Taking pleasure in triumphing over others, taking pleasure in having control over others, taking pleasure in the suffering of others, taking pleasure in being the cause of the suffering of others, taking pleasure in the death of others, and then the extra 37 blows that words can't seem to explain. What response can we have when this creature approaches? Self-deception, too, we've learned, is a thunderingly powerful force in human affairs. No one can hide from it. No one is exempt from it. The ability to believe falsely that we know our own motives and that those motives are good is an affliction that can befall those whose motives were once indeed good just as easily as it can befall those whose motives have always been bad. And just as the possession of wealth or a high status in society makes a person's engine of self-deception race faster, so too does the possession of power over others, and so too does the use of physical violence. It seems undeniable that once it begins, violence leads us into some sort of madness, some terrifying maze inside the mind in which we become lost and we don't know what's happening or what we ourselves are doing. In 1945, a group of us dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima. Various people gave explanations for that. And then 3 days later, we dropped another atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Were there explanations for that as well? It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I'm saying that the means of violence should not be entrusted to members of the human race. Power over the lives of other human beings should not be entrusted to members of the human race. I think that the long scientific experiment has given us some very clear results by now. Humans are not equipped to handle these things. Most of those who have dreamed of a more just world, who have perhaps spent their lives trying to prepare for one, have confronted the cold intransigence of the world's entrenched elites, the dug-in repositories of luck and strength, and they've come to the conclusion that these ruthlessly greedy and heartless people will never give up power if blood is not spilled, that only violence can possibly dislodge them. And yet, those who triumph in violent combat are by definition triumphant. They're by definition victors. And they're by definition powerful. And whatever else they are, at that moment of victory, they're strong and they're lucky. At least at that moment, they've become the lucky elite. And this brings us naturally to the questions of revenge and punishment, because if the unlucky were ever indeed to remove the lucky from their current position of supremacy, the issue of what to do about the lucky would immediately be on the table, and the questions of revenge and punishment would immediately arise. We all naturally dream of revenge. It's one of the most enjoyable and thrilling of fantasies. We all become excited when we imagine the day when those whom we've learned to despise, those whom we feel have gotten away with so much for so long, will finally pay a price, will finally receive the reward they've earned. And yet, the person who takes revenge at that very moment becomes too powerful. The person who punishes at that very moment, becomes too powerful. There's no reason to doubt that every healthy human infant is born with the potential to play music beautifully, to read with sensitivity, to do scientific research, to put on plays, to draw and paint, and certainly to think. To think, to understand, to reason, to analyze arguments, and naturally also to develop, to grow. But almost all of those who are born unlucky have been brutally prevented from developing more than a fraction of their own abilities. And this is perhaps the most shocking fact about our human world. Undoubtedly less shocking, but possibly more weird, is the incredible fact that in the contemporary world, many even of those who are born lucky are voluntarily foregoing the opportunity to develop their inner resources. Gorgeous and delicious fruits grown by seductive geniuses sit on the plates of these lucky people but remain uneaten. A process of decay has infected the lucky in various parts of the world, and very notably in the United States, leading many, even of the luckiest, to turn vehemently against complex thought in general and the cultivation of the intellect in particular, and even to turn against complex pleasures. Night is a wonderful blessing. It's amazing, and I'm so grateful for it. In the darkness, lying in bed, we can stop. To be able to stop, that's amazing. We can stop, we can think. Of course, it's frightening, too. We think of what may happen to us. We think about death. Murder and murderers stand around the bed. But night gives us a chance to consider the possibility that we can start again, that when day comes, we can begin again in a different way. The aggressiveness that has been our daily mode of being can't help us anymore. We wake up and start massacring people whom we see as our enemies. We wake up and break into the earth with gigantic drills and terrifying explosions. We wake up and find our place in a monstrous struggle. On the one side, they're all the lucky people. And on the other side, strangely allied together, we find all the unlucky people, plus the birds, the crickets, the ladybugs, the bees, the monkeys, the parrots, the forests, and the rivers. At the moment, the lucky people are clearly winning, and almost all of the evidence seems to indicate that they'll ultimately prevail. The non-human creatures and the unlucky people are running from place to place, gassed, strafed, shot at, booby-trapped, gasping for breath. And the living planet that we've blasted and bombed and injected with poison is now like an enormous animal who's been tortured for hours by some horribly disturbed, demented children, finally beginning to end. And its terrible groans are dreadful to hear. But the animal may not die. If we can convince the children, who are ourselves, to stop killing it. It's perhaps still a possibility that we might be able to stop being murderers. This could be our night. And during this night, we might be able to stop. Stop, think, and start again in a different way. Well, I'll stop there. Thank you. It does actually make sense if you read the whole thing from the beginning to the end. Comments, personal questions, inappropriate thoughts. Yes.
I know you've done a number of books with essays. How do you decide what you're going to start in? Like, what is going to be your
Well, I've published one previous collection of essays, and most of them were on one subject, really. This one was more a realization. It came from a realization that, well, let's not say me, but many people around my age, not you either who are here in this room, but it sometimes happens that we fall over and die, or that we become less sharp. Although, as we know, Verdi composed his opera Falstaff when he was 80, and Kurosawa made Ron when he was 80, and many people do great work. De Kooning's paintings are great even when he was supposedly out of it. People said he was out of it. But I sort of thought, oh, maybe I should write down really everything that I think. In a hurry, really. And that, as far as the shape of it goes, well, I sort of wrote down everything I thought. This happened in two stages, but it's a little bit boring to describe that. But I, when I had assembled everything I thought, a sort of logic did come to me that led it from the beginning to the end. I mean, I should say, it was really my publisher's idea to do any of this. Anthony Arnov of Haymarket Books is among you tonight. You can each ask each other, are you him? That's sort of the answer, yes.
Well, I hate to be living in the past and dragging you with me, but I was wondering if you had any comments about the making of My Dinner with Andre, and also you said at one point that there were only two lies in that movie, one was that you never actually had dinner together, and I forgot the other lie.
I don't remember either. Say, before you asked about the two lies, what did you ask?
Oh, I just wondered if you had any comments about the making of My Dinner with Andre. It's such a unique and interesting film. And also, if you had any comments
about your impressions about it. Well, our friend is talking about a movie that I worked on in the 70s, and it was released in 1981, and it showed the theater director Andre Gregory and me talking for that was an earlier time. I mean, here it's understood that one can only... We talked for an hour and three quarters, to be honest. I mean, it was a fake conversation. It was scripted, but it was the idea was that we were talking, And we, you know, we acted it well enough, playing sort of versions of ourselves, so that many people did believe it was spontaneous. Yes, and we that was written in a way partly to be funny, but it Andre said some serious things, and I even said a few, and so I don't know. It did lay a groundwork for my taking myself, you know, seriously in that way that you've just experienced for perhaps too long. But I, you know, I've always had, and of course, by the way, I defy anybody to define funny or serious, really. Serious, you can sort of begin to define. Funny, I don't know if anyone here could define. But certainly, I don't know, another person here tonight, you could ask each other if they are them. I wrote a play in collaboration with one of the people here when I was 13. It was quite serious, dealt with some of the same issues, not identically. Anybody else? Yes.
It seems to me that as you ponder all these big questions, all you do is find four questions to ask. Civilization would stay, what is it on the earth? I mean, there is no answer. There's just so many more questions.
I suppose I my natural tendency is to be ask questions, but I suppose I've come to a few conclusions, really.
I mean, there's always lingering,
Well, no, but you're right. I do think it's, we have to re-examine our thoughts. But somehow I have made a journey from being born a sort of centrist liberal and growing up that way to being to being a sort of card-carrying leftist, I suppose. So I'm not completely agnostic about absolutely everything, but yes, just as we question our the people we admire the most and think about, what about this and what about that? Yes.
What are all the notes you have in your own?
The notes that I have in my own book are my attempt to illustrate to myself what part of it I'm reading today, because I sadly can't read the whole thing. I could read it, but it's just not the way this type of game is played.
Wally. First of all, My Dinner with Andre is one of the all-time great movies of all time. And it was such a moving experience for me. And that scene after where you're riding in the cab thinking about Your Dinner with Andre and that music, Eric Satie, it's one of the most poignant pieces of film ever in history for me. And to be here tonight with you and to find out that Anthony Arnoff is your publisher. He's our publisher for Dick Doyle, the book I published, which I gave you before. He handles our foreign editions of the book. I didn't know this at all. I just, when I thought you were going to be here, I came, but I knew you were an anti-war person. And I wanted to give you all my magical material. But I'm just so moved by what you and what you wrote. and so many, you're great in everything you're in. Oh my God, the Princess Bride, and the Toy Story. Oh, I wish our daughter could come with us tonight, you know. But just thank you for everything.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, obviously, you know, we could have a different evening where people who knew critical things about me could offer them up, and that would be true of any writer, really. There could be a celebratory evening and perhaps an evening of denunciation.
Inconceivable.
Yeah. But, yes, certainly nice things have been said about My Dinner with Andre, which is a good movie. It's, and it's, you know, you look it up and thank you kindly. Yes. Well, I think once it was intentional, because I thought, what have I done? That's the wrong word. And once I misread the beginning of the sentence, so in order to be sure that everybody followed what I was trying to say, I sort of fixed the sentence halfway through. This is a very intimate revelation of, yes. Oh no, clarity came much later. I mean, I actually started off really with the story of going to the apartment and the person. This is another person you can ask if it's the person sitting next to you. They are in the room. The person who raised the question of whether civilization might be a mistake. I mean, that was sort of a starting point. And I actually had been asked by Anthony Arnov to give a talk at the conference that you're all invited to, which happens every year, the Socialism Conference, which happens in Chicago, but a lot of people from this coast and the other coasts somehow make their way to Chicago. It's in July every year, and it has a different name every year. This year it is Socialism 2018. So, I was invited to give a talk, and I did, but I knew that it was totally incomplete, and I was making points without justifying them, and it was unclear, and in a way, I was humiliated to think that it was so unsupported. I said a lot of things that I didn't think I really justified. And then Anthony asked me to maybe make a book out of it. And so I took all the time that I needed and much more time than I'd spent on the original talk, and I also removed most of the sentences from the talk and replace them with better ones. But there's some things that still remain. So yes, that's how I write generally. I mean, even writing a play, I never know even remotely what it would be about. I just write it. I mean, I start writing and then learn and then begin to guess what it's about in a way. Yes. Well, I mean, compared to, compared to most of the time that I've been alive, people are a million times more aware of the issue of exploitation and more eager to change the world for the better, except for the brief years which I did live through, let's say between 68 and 73, those also were years in which people wanted to create a better world and in a way were more willing to examine absolutely everything and start absolutely from scratch. I mean, this would, but the question is what, I mean, not, I know so many people, maybe 98% of the people in the room here have that desire to do something to prevent the horrors that are taking place, and make change for the better, but a lot of people are mixed up about what to do. Interestingly, I visited Germany pretty recently, and my friend and I noticed that absolutely every person we met was in contact with Syrian refugees and helping them out in some way. I mean, everybody that we met. So, I'm wondering what we should, I mean, is anybody would like to advise, let's say that there was somebody, me, let's say, and wanted some good ideas. Give up my entire life and go somewhere else. I want to stay in vaguely this country. Are people in this room doing things that they find beneficial and valuable that they would like to tell us about or maybe advise me or others to do? Please.
Just one thing I've participated in, say, something that I've done necessarily, but on Twitter, I know that can be quite a fishbowl, but we were quite successful at getting a number of organizations to distance themselves from the NRA, which then gives courage to lawmakers who have been trying to get gun control through for many years to fight harder. And hope, I mean, the thing that I'm hoping most personally is that we can encourage more people to become registered to vote and to actually vote and to vote out people with whom the voters don't agree with instead of worrying about it after the fact.
I would say one of the ways to combat it is like the 60s, they had these massive teach-ins, bring people together. Now there's so much disinformation out there. We really need to bring people together and educate them, first of all. how to recognize disinformation, and then working with people. I mean, Facebook, all that stuff's great, but it's kind of a fake community. It's coming together, bringing people together, interacting with one another person that creates community. And there's so many people that feel detached. I think that's part of the problem. Many of the problems we have, they just cut themselves off and not part of something.
And certainly, de-education is something that has obviously, ruined our country. Because if people were using the analytical skills that I think they were all born with and had as infants, we wouldn't have Trump and even the whole idea of money in politics would be somewhat meaningless, because most of that money goes to buy idiotic advertising that an aware public would not pay any attention to in any case. Other thoughts? Hello.
I do something that's just very concrete. Every Monday, I deliver Meals on Wheels to elderly people who do not leave their home. And I think if everyone just started by doing something kind in their community and it radiated out, it would make a big sea change in the world. And we all are very insulated with our little machines in our hands, and we don't even talk to each other anymore. Face to face. So when they open the door and I give them their food and I ask them how are they, and they smile and I smile, that changes the world right there, I think.
I agree.
Well, I'm part of a social justice worker at UCLA, and we're establishing a social justice fund there. People volunteer to go into prisons who are professors at UCLA, and we teach in prisons. And sometimes people do a one-off, and sometimes people do a whole class. But it made an enormous difference, because there's a proposition in California that the more units you take in prison, the shorter your term is. So
wow.
Actually creating, getting people out of prison. And it's changing people's lives, and it really is. And we're starting small. You know, it's like not going to talk about picking a little hatchet and cutting down a big tree. And that's the thing about social change, is that you really need to be willing to do something that's really boring and involves, you know, Xeroxing things and asking for money, but it is happening. And I mean, people are engaged in ways because there's a kind of desperation. And some of us are getting close to being on our way out, so we can sort of see. I mean, I was hearing something but you can just throw up your hands. You know, maybe it just sucks and then you die. But the thing is that just staying engaged is. And I think the badness of our current situation, the desperation of having the kind of relationship so high that we have, has engaged people much more quickly than when Obama was president. It's like, oh, let him do it, you know.
For sure.
So we need more bad presidents.
And but also, I must say, one is. I mean, for those of us not from California, by the way, it's great to, California is obviously doing amazing things and so far ahead of the rest of the country. Don't secede. I mean, we need you.
To your friends. Tell us about that.
Well, our friend has mentioned something, well, a play that I wrote quite a while ago, 25 years ago, which was kind of like as if I was giving a secret, as if there was a secret meeting of the bourgeoisie, letting our hair down about what we really felt. I mean, that's one way of describing it. It has a story, and it's like a little, it is a play, a one-person play, but it had some cruel self-analysis, let's say, of that would make any privileged person squirm a bit, I would say, if they were still listening. And I did do that play for about a year in people's apartments, starting with friends, and then friends of friends, and their friends, and so that it was kind of putting people on the spot in a way, but not too many people took it that way. I mean, they weren't. I didn't spring it on them. I mean, they knew that that was going to be happening, that there was going to be a play that's going to was going to last for a long time, and there was a guy talking. It was surprisingly few people said, well, you're denouncing me for being privileged, and I believe in having my privileges, and I don't like you anymore. Very few people even came close to that. And I don't know why, but that's true.
I was just wondering, during the writing of this book, if there were any other authors or thinkers or even art that was inspiring you,
Well, no, I wasn't really, thinking, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I wasn't, I was thinking mostly about myself. I wasn't really thinking of other people who had inspired me. I mean, I listened to a lot of music, classical music, and I go to a lot of concerts, and I think that does something to me. I like a lot of contemporary music, and I think that inspires me, but I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people who, if you want to make a literary analysis after my death, you can say he obviously, if it weren't for, you know, Beckett, there wouldn't be that guy. But I don't think that way myself.
Are you happy? Are you sad? Is it too short? Is it too long? Are you ready? Are you not?
I mean, if you're asking me really the honest answer, if everybody that I had known had been indifferent to it, I probably would have said, well, you know, I did my best, and it didn't really hit the target. As it happened, my friends were quite into this one. I mean, I can't predict, because a lot of my friends have disappeared and don't mention it.
I mean, they've disappeared as far as this book goes. But in the early days of when it came out, an awful lot of people were very, very friendly about it. So I began to think, well, this must be good. And I feel a kind of confidence about it. I mean, that's the honest answer. I think if it's very, very hard to... Yeah, but now I feel I did what I wanted to do. And now we can't go on forever, I don't think, because, you know, there's a limit. I don't want this session to turn into the denunciation session. Maybe there'd be one more comment from this gentleman, and then we'll leave it alone.
I saw you in the Designated Mourner here not too long ago, and I think that had been a revised version of that play. And I was wondering, had those revisions been circulating for a long time, or was that a very recent thing when you put that remarks on?
Well, it wasn't that revised. I mean, it was. I have to say, I do keep changing my plays, and I've changed all of my plays, even after they were published. In one case, I paid a publisher, not Anthony, it's a different publisher. I paid the publisher to reprint the play in a newer version. And I'm glad I did. Yeah, I can't help it. I just do see mistakes or things that could be done much better. So I changed them. Friends, it's been great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.